This is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome all of you to our sixth and final class of the Diabetes Fundamentals. And it's been such a pleasure having you join me for these programs and joining us from all across the country. We're gathering as a community to learn what we can about diabetes care and the best management possible to improve outcomes for the people with diabetes. And as you know, 1 in 10 Americans currently have diabetes. And 1 in 3 people are living with prediabetes. So we certainly have an epidemic on hand. And whatever information we could pass along to our patients and share with providers and as consultants can really help to improve those outcomes. So I thank you for joining me. I thank you for your participation. And today's class is really kind of a melding of a lot of different topics. We're going to be talking about hypoglycemia, sick days, monitoring, foot care, and spiritual aspects. And I find that the spiritual aspect of diabetes is very important because people come to us with their life stories and their challenges, you know, personal challenges and challenges with diabetes self-management. And we want to really listen to them, hear them, and provide a safe space for them to learn about diabetes and make those changes in their behavior and diabetes self-management. So we'll wrap up with that. So without any further important. Okay, and then the other thing we might notice if they're having low blood sugars is that in the morning, their blood sugars are high. They have rebound hyperglycemia. And so if a patient wakes up and they always have high morning blood sugars, we want to think backward and assess if they're getting low in the middle of the night. So asking them these questions to see, did they get low in the middle of the night? And if you're not sure, we could always have them do a few 3 a.m. blood glucose checks to see if they are getting low. So hypoglycemia awareness is awareness that your body is getting low. It's adrenergically based. It's our stress hormones. It's our corticosteroids and our adrenaline that are released when our blood sugar is less than 70. And these are life-saving hormones because they tell us you need to eat. You need to take action to get your blood sugars up. But after 2 to 5 years of type 1 diabetes, glucagon secretion is impaired and epinephrine secretion becomes primary mechanism to restore blood glucose level. So glucagon, as you know, is a hormone released by the pancreas that tells the liver to release sugar. So even after a short time of having type 1 diabetes, since type 1 diabetes attacks the pancreas, not only are the insulin-producing cells destroyed, but also the alpha cells that make the glucagon are destroyed. So both alpha and beta cells get attacked in type 1 diabetes. So you make less insulin and less glucagon. That's why people with type 1 diabetes oftentimes struggle with being able to detect low blood sugar because over time, epinephrine secretion they're relying on epinephrine, but even over time, that response might be diminished or delayed. And so they lose their glucagon and they might lose their epinephrine. And this is called hypoglycemia unawareness. So this equals danger for people living with diabetes. If they can't tell they have low, they don't know to treat it. And so if you're working with patients who are struggling, they say to you, you know, I just don't feel my blood sugar's low. And they check it and I'm shocked to see how low it is. What we want to do is teach them about blood glucose awareness training. And what they want to do is really try to identify any signs or symptoms associated with low blood sugar. So they want to get a symptom diary. Every time they get a low, write down any symptoms that they could feel. And I had one guy, he had really bad hypoglycemia unawareness, and he finally identified that his lip twitched when his blood sugar went low. And so he knew from then on if his lip twitched. Sometimes people say they get numb around the mouth. That's another sign that I've heard people say. So you want to log each hypoglycemic event and try to identify symptoms and the pre-event associated behavior. What does that mean? What was I doing before I got hypoglycemia? Did I skip a meal? Maybe they were drinking alcohol. Alcohol definitely is a risk for hypoglycemia. And the other thing we want to consider is beta blockers. Beta blockers are a type of blood pressure medication that might block early signs of hypoglycemia. But I do want to tell you, perspiration is not masked by beta blockers. So that might be a sign they could, something they could look for to see if their blood sugar is low. So if you're working with a patient, particularly with type 1 diabetes, they don't feel when their blood sugar goes low and they get into trouble. They're getting into trouble because they don't feel that it's low. We definitely want to help them to do this awareness training. Log their lows, look at the events before their lows, see if we can prevent it, and then any symptoms. But the other important thing is if they have hypoglycemia unawareness, studies show that if they can keep their blood sugars higher, around 90. Don't let the blood sugar go below 90 or 100 for about 3 weeks. They can oftentimes regain their sense of feeling low blood sugars, so they can reestablish some of that epinephrine response. Okay, so treatment of low blood sugar, let's talk about that. If the blood sugar, blood glucose is 70 or below, 10 to 15 grams of carb, and I really encourage my patients to have snacks available in case of low, so important. And 15 gram snacks, because when your blood sugar glucose is low, you're really tempted to eat a large amount of food. And then a lot of patients struggle with overeating, and then they're like, what do I do now because my blood sugar is so high? So try and stick to 15 grams. If they're very low, they might have to consume 30 grams of carbohydrate. Very important to retest in 15 minutes. If still below 70, 15 more grams. And really, really important is follow up with usual meal or snack. And if that blood sugar went less than 40, that's neuroglycopenia. It's going to take time for the brain to recover. Really encourage people then to give the brain recovery time. So just rest and relax and recover before driving or operating any equipment or anything that could be dangerous. Now, severe hypoglycemia means you cannot treat yourself. So these are patients who are so low they can't figure out how to treat themselves. Maybe they're on the verge of passing out, or maybe they have passed out. So in this situation, and I've been in situations in restaurants where this has happened, and the patient was on the verge of passing out, and I was afraid they would aspirate, so I actually asked for some honey, and we just put some honey inside of their cheek, and that helped them to regain consciousness. So you can do corn syrup or icing gel or honey inside the cheek, rub it in, and if they have glucagon emergency kit, great. So that would be on the outpatient side. We might use some glucagon emergency kit to get that blood sugar back up. And if they're in the hospital, we're going to use this D50 IV. But the glucagon injection, we'll look at a picture in a minute. Glucagon emergency kit is just powdered glucagon. And that's what our pancreas makes, glucagon, to tell the liver to release its glucose stores. And adults, we give the full dose. In kids, we give half the dose, only 0.5 milligrams if they're less than 20 kilograms. When you give glucagon, it's an intramuscular injection. The patient will gain consciousness in maybe 10, 15 minutes, but the action is short-lived. So as soon as they can, they need to drink something to get their blood sugar back up, or else their blood sugar will plummet again. And they must take carbohydrate as soon as possible and keep snacking until blood sugars are sustained. You know, when we give glucagon, what we've done is actually we've told the liver to release its glucose stores. So the liver now is all tapped out. There's no reserves left. So we need to get the body reserve built back up. Glucagon can expire, so we need to check the expiration date. Here's a glucagon emergency kit, and you can see it's fluid plus powder, so you have to push the fluid into this vial, shake it up, mix it, pull it back into the syringe, and then inject it. So it is, you know, if your loved one is passed out and you have to reconstitute this glucagon emergency kit, it can be really nerve-wracking. And so we want to give the patients family training on this, and get a sample kit if you can from your reps so that they can practice with it and get comfortable with it. So having a glucagon emergency kit on board is really important for patients with type 1 diabetes especially, or actually any patient who's suffering with severe hypoglycemia. The American Diabetes Association says, ask those at risk for hypo about frequency and symptoms of hypoglycemia at each visit. So even though you've been working with a patient who's been on insulin for years and diabetes for years, if they're at risk for hypoglycemia, we need to evaluate how many lows are you getting a week? How low is it going? Are you feeling the lows? What are you doing to treat the lows? Do you have glucose on you you know, our carbohydrate on you at all times. So this is a very important part of our assessment. We want to make sure anybody at risk for hypo has a glucagon prescription and they actually, you know, have the glucagon emergency kit. And we need to not instruct a person with diabetes, obviously, but the family and caregivers on how to use it. Hypoglycemia unawareness, or one event of severe hypoglycemia, indicates regimen adjustment is needed. This is new guidelines by the ADA. So if the patient comes in and says, I don't feel lows, or I had a very severe low, I needed the assistance of someone else, that tells us they're probably over-insulinized, they're over-medicated. We need to pull back. And here's what I was talking about earlier, raise glycemic targets for several weeks to get the epinephrine response reestablished. It can help. The other thing is monitoring itself of your blood glucose or continuous glucose monitoring are essential tools. So here you can see we have a patient on an insulin pump and also a continuous glucose monitor. So her body, this monitor is looking at her interstitial fluid and giving her a feedback, you know, very regularly about what her blood sugars are. So she has a glimpse throughout the day of what she's trending and if she's at risk for low blood sugar. So continuous glucose monitoring is very helpful for patients who are struggling with hypoglycemia so they can take action to prevent it. They can see their trends. Trends are really important for people with diabetes because when you can see those numbers heading down, you could take action early on. And then insulin pump therapy too can help patients to really fine-tune their insulin delivery amounts to prevent hypoglycemia. So how do we help our patients prevent low? Well, I have here, if bedtime glucose less than 110, eat a snack. Critical information for our patients to know. If you're going to go to bed and your blood sugar is less than 110, have a carbohydrate snack. It has to be a carbohydrate. I had a patient say, well, I have cauliflower before I go to bed if my blood sugar is low. Well, that ain't going to cut it unless you eat a lot of cauliflower. You know, I really want you to have a piece of fruit or, you know, a sandwich, a half a sandwich or something like that. But the other thing, if they're always running less than 110 at bedtime, we need to adjust their medications. They're taking too much medication at dinner. That's really what I'm looking for. So we would need to make some adjustments. The other thing is if they had an unusually active day, we may need to give them an extra bedtime snack. So what if a patient is usually, you know, had an unusual day. They were raking the leaves or shoveling snow, or they rode one for a, you know, 2-hour bike ride. They usually never do that. They may need to eat more because we'll see nocturnal hypoglycemia happen in those situations. They get low in the middle of the night from daytime activity because their muscles are chewing up a lot of sugar. Evaluate pre-dinner insulin and medications. So if we're getting nighttime lows, we need to make adjustments in medications. You could say they should eat more at dinner, but I would always say if we can, let's cut back on the insulin or medications. We don't want people to feed the insulin. We want to cover and give just what they need. Other things that can lead to hypoglycemia, we want to monitor their kidney function. And a lot of patients who come to diabetes classes, they lose weight. And as they lose weight, their medication needs go down. So always as we see weight loss occurring, we want to down-adjust their medications, insulin, oral medications, and many times they'll need changes in their blood pressure medications too because as you lose weight, your blood pressure goes down. We want to monitor trends. We want to evaluate too many meds. And are they skipping meals? So that's a big deal if they're on, you know, intensive insulin therapy or sulfonylureas. Skipping meals can be very dangerous. So if that's the case, if they know every day they're having trouble getting lunch, let's adjust their regimen so that if they don't eat lunch, they won't crash. You could say, hey, they should just be eating lunch. That's the best case scenario, but sometimes patients just can't make that happen. So we're going to work the insulin and the medication to match their lifestyle. Plan ahead. Talk about alcohol. If you're going to drink, you got to eat. That's my number one rule because alcohol does cause low blood sugar. So for every alcohol beverage, have 15 grams of carb. And, of course, you know, trying not to drink more than moderation. You know, that's always what we're trying to share with them. But just the main thing, if you're going to drink, you got to eat. So if on insulin or sulfonylurea, special precautions required, they need to have a carbohydrate source on them at all times. I was teaching a diabetes class to patients the other day, and this gal had a low blood sugar, and she had no carbohydrate source on her body and her person. And so it was such a great teaching moment for the whole class, because I said, you know, if you're on sulfonylureas or insulin, you need to have something on you in case you go low. Identification, so important. What if you're passed out and you can't tell people who you are or who to contact for emergency? So on the phone, you know, the in case of emergency ICE, and a lot of the new iPhones now have like a medic alert bracelet symbol on the phone that an emergency person could press and get information about you. A wallet card, I'm going to put this in your resource list for this fundamental, so you can download a wallet card that I pass out to all my patients in class where they can put all their medications, who to contact in case of emergency, and keep it in their wallet. And a bracelet is always a good idea. So talking about getting a diabetes bracelet, and they have a lot of cute ones now. They're not, you know, the ugly standard ones we were familiar with when we were growing up, but there's a lot of good-looking bracelets out there. And then looking at if there's a pattern of low med adjustment required. Here's our pre-meal target. It used to be 70 to 130. It's 80 to 130. And so now I feel better about that number because it's safer for patients. If they're going below 80, I know medication adjustment is needed because they're getting closer to risking hypoglycemia. The post-meal less than 180, and then bedtime. This is not a published number, bedtime 110 to 180, but you'll see it appearing in diabetes journals, and that I feel very comfortable with this, saying if you're on insulin or sulfonylureas, you need to get that bedtime blood sugar above 110. And if it's lower than that, eat, and then let's take a look at your medications. So let's do a live study. A patient on glyburide tells you, I feel funny when my blood sugars go to 140. And what I'm going to do right now is launch a poll to see what would we do. And glyburide, as you know, is a sulfonylurea. So what would be the right response? I feel funny when my blood sugars go to 140. What do you think might be causing that? Are her blood sugars running lower than targets? Maybe her meter's broken? Or C, she is eating too much processed foods? Or D, her blood sugars run chronically high? What do you think's happening here? Why would a patient say, I feel funny when my blood sugars are at 140? Okay, thanks for voting, everybody. I'll take one more second. Is it her blood sugars are running lower than target, her meter's broken, she's eating too much processed food, or her blood sugars are running chronically high? What do you think? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. Oh, good. We had one more vote. Thank you. And share this with you. Okay. So 13% of you said her blood sugars are running lower than target. Actually, that's not the right answer let's just keep going. That's not the right answer. Let's keep that in our mind. Her meter must be broken. Nobody chose that. Good job. She's eating too much processed food. Probably not the right answer either, but D is the right answer. Her blood sugars are running chronically high. And this patient, when I hear somebody tell me, I don't feel low, I feel low when my blood sugars are at 140, I know they're probably running in the 300s. They run 300, 300, 300 all the time. Like, without even knowing what her A1C is, I'm sure it's around 10. Because her glucose thermostat has been readjusted up. That is, she's running 300 all the time, so when she gets to 140, her body goes into panic because it's not used to running that low. And she probably does release a little epinephrine when she's at 140 because her body is readjusted to 300. So when I see a patient like this, I know they're really struggling with hyperglycemia, and I'm going to ask them, have you ever had a low blood sugar in the past? And many of these patients had a severe low, and they're doing everything to avoid low blood sugars, and they're letting it run high. So I want to address the fear and say, you know what, let's work on getting your blood sugars closer to target. So if this patient is running 300, I'm not going to say, let's get your pre-meal blood sugar to 80 to 130. you know, within this next week. It's not realistic. I'm going to say, let's get your blood sugar less than 250 for a week, and then less than 200, and then less than 190. I'm going to gently bring it down over a few months so she can readjust to having a normal blood glucose level. And she might say, well, can I treat this 140? And I would say, well, just have a hard candy. It's only 5 grams of carbohydrate. And she doesn't really need any food. She's not in danger of passing out, but she feels bad. So I'm going to treat that, you know, psychologically and say, have that candy, and that'll help her feel better and get past that moment. And I'm gradually going to work with her to bring her blood sugars down over time. And always so important, find out what her fear is. Why is she letting it run high? Patient on insulin tells you, I only feel hypoglycemic when my blood sugars go below 50. Let's launch this one. What is going on here? He has A, successfully adjusted to his diabetes. He has hypoglycemia unawareness, B. Or C, he needs to review the symptoms of hypoglycemia. Or D, he needs to do quality control on his meter. Which do you think is the right answer? All right, you guys are on fire right now. That's all I could say. Okay, it's looking great. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share with you. 100% of you said he has hypoglycemia unawareness. Absolutely. So when a patient comes into my office and they say this to me, this, like a bell, a radar, a sonic boom goes off in my mind, and I'm like, we've got to take care of this right away because this is very dangerous. And so I'm going to talk to them about making sure they have food in case they go low, about checking their blood sugar more frequently, and I'm going to have a heart-to-heart conversation and say, would you be willing for a few weeks to let your blood sugars, you know, stay around 90 to 130, 100 to 130? And we know from studies, and this is a work from Philip Cryer, C-R-Y-E-R, that if you keep your blood sugars above 90 and 100 for your few weeks, you can regain some of that response to hypoglycemia. So I just want to tell you, a lot of patients who let their blood sugars run in the 50s are very afraid of complications, and they want to get their A1C as close to normal as possible, and I admire that, and I honor that. But the problem is they're getting them too low, and they're a danger. And so this is such a fine balance to, you know, this tightrope to walk. If we go too low, you're in danger. If you go too high, you're at risk for complications. So I totally understand and relate to that. But we really want to encourage patients to be safe. And also, we're going to talk to them about blood glucose awareness training. Write down your symptoms when you get low. Can you identify anything, anything at all that tells you you're getting low so you can catch it before you get into a danger zone? All right, so that kind of wraps up our hypoglycemia, and I just want to make sure you can all see this next slide that's on the screen. It says monitoring sick day management and hospital goals, and if you can't, just write a little note in the questions, and I'll fix it, but I think you all can see, because I'm not seeing any comments in the question part of the box there on your right-hand side. So that's hypoglycemia. Let's kind of switch gears and talk about monitoring sick day management and hospitals. In hospital management. And so the question is, you know, I work with a lot of patients who are newly diagnosed, and I say to them, would you be interested in checking your blood sugar? So we're always going to ask permission before we just say, oh, you have to check your blood sugars now that you have diabetes. So you want to engage them in this decision-making process, just like we engage them in taking medications. And so the patient might say to me, well, why should I check my blood sugars? Because let's be honest, it is not pleasant checking your blood sugars. It is not pleasant poking your fingers. We know that. It's a pain, right? You got to find your meter. You got to get the blood. You got to, you know, you got to write down what your blood sugars was, what your blood sugars are. So there's a lot of work involved. So we need to provide reasons why this is important. And they have to believe and buy into those reasons. You feel better every day. You have a sense of control and mastery. You're less likely to be hospitalized for blood sugars out of control. So again, it kind of comes back to you being empowered. You're less likely to miss work and school, and You can avoid hypoglycemic situations, when you're driving and getting low, or you're at work and you get low, or you're, in situations you really want to avoid hypoglycemia. And then I have this interesting thing. You want to avoid unwanted weight gain. Why would that happen? Well, if you're on too much medications and your blood sugars keep getting low, you start to eat to treat the low and you gain weight. So if you keep an eye on your blood sugars and you see they're running low, it gives us a sign to down adjust your medication dose. And when your blood sugars are at target, you have better athletic performance. So we're going to gear this conversation around what's important to the patient, of course. Okay, adult learners want to know, how is it going to help me? And the main thing, I'm just kind of continuing this conversation of strategies to help patients understand the importance of blood glucose monitoring. Oops, I kind of got excited there. Let me go back. To see if your treatment plan is working. And so we talk a lot about this. When you get your blood sugar result, it is not a personal reflection on you as a person. And it's a reflection of if the treatment plan is working. And that the treatment plan are your medications, your food, and your activity. Those three factors affect your blood sugar. So you want to see if one of those factors is out of whack and we need to make adjustments to it. And it helps us make decisions regarding food, avoiding and adjusting medications when exercising, because exercise is like a medication. It's going to lower the blood sugars. So we want to monitor blood sugars, before and after activity to see, hey, maybe we should cut back on some medications before exercise. And then here's my favorite one. We want to find out how pizza affected your blood glucose. A lot of people think diabetes means I can't eat pizza or Chinese food anymore. Listen, do an experiment for me. Test your blood sugar before you go out to pizza, and then 2 hours after you eat pizza, see what happens. Maybe pizza is okay. And if it does go above target, maybe try eating a little bit less. And the same for Chinese food. This is called paired glucose testing. See how different things affect your blood sugar, and it gives you immediate feedback on how to make changes. You want to find patterns. Many times we'll ask our patients to check their blood sugars more frequently at first, and after we identify patterns and see when they're running low or high, we can make adjustments in their medications, and once we get it settled down, they may have to check less often. So this is very important. If at first they're checking more frequently because they're trying to figure out where they are with their diabetes and their plan, and then if their blood sugars start, coming in target 80 or 90% of the time, maybe we can cut back on glucose monitoring. Let's always make sure what we ask them to do is worth it. So how often should people check? We want to be realistic. It's so important. And I just want to tell you that if the patient has Medicare and they have type 2 diabetes on oral medication, Medicare only covers 100 strips for 3 months. That's a strip a day. So if you tell a patient with type 2 on metformin to check twice a day, they're going to have to buy 100 extra strips. So we want to be realistic and work within their framework. And actually, studies show that if you're type 2 on orals, checking more than once a day doesn't improve outcomes. So this is based on some great studies by the VA. And that's where Medicare kind of figured out this amount. But if they're type 1 and they're on intensive insulin therapy, we might need to check a lot more frequently. It's based on the individual, the frequency of testing, the type and timing of meds or insulin, what are the goals, what is their ability, look at this, physical and emotional. Some of your patients, maybe you're just barely able to handle diabetes. We don't want to tell them to check 4 times a day. They won't be able to achieve it. Maybe once a day is enough for them. Or maybe we say, can you check 2 times a week? So we're always going to negotiate based on where the patient comes from. And then their finances, our insurance, what is the out-of-pocket cost for them? So the American Diabetes Association says we want to self-monitor before meals, snacks, and bedtime as needed based on the individual. And occasionally, we want to check after meals and before exercise. When a patient suspects hypoglycemia, keep checking. So if they think they're low, and make sure you eat first always, but check that blood sugar and then make sure you keep checking until it's back in its safe zone. So the reason the ADA says this is they want to give justification to insurance companies for some people who need a lot of strips. Really, for type 1s, they may use, you know, 8 or more strips a day. And so these are reasons why a person on intensive insulin therapy would need to check their blood sugar frequently. Check blood glucose before critical tasks such as driving. Oh my gosh, anybody on insulin or sulfonylurea before they get behind the wheel should really know that their blood sugar is in a safe zone. Be practical. No two patients or 2 days are alike. That's great. I love that. Let's take a look at this patient. She's newly diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. She's 62 years old. She came in for treatment for her urinary tract infection. Now she finds out she has diabetes, so she's kind of upset. She came in for a UTI, and now she's like, I came in for a urinary tract infection, and you guys gave me diabetes, right? Well, we know we didn't give her diabetes. We know that urinary tract infections are often a sign of diabetes, so she might have had it for a while. Her A1C is 6.7. So we're getting her ready to do some diabetes self-care. How often does she need to check? Or what if her blood, her A1C is 10.4? How often does she need to check? So let me just launch a little poll here. This is kind of interesting. Does she need to check once a day, twice a day, 2 to 3 times a day, or 4 times a day? And if we think about this, if her A1C is 6.7, if we look at the ADA medication algorithm, we would definitely start her on exercise, nutrition therapy, have her see a dietitian, and attend a diabetes self-management course. But also, metformin might be an option for her too, right? Get her on some metformin. So those are 3 things we're going to start, and now we're going to ask her to check her blood sugar. What is reasonable to ask her to do? How often should she check? If her A1C is 6.7, we know her average blood sugar is, you know, around the 140 mark. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this and share. Okay, 71% of you said she should check once a day. 14% of you said twice a day. And 14% said 2 to 3 times a day. And I'm going to go with A. Okay, there's no one right answer here. We're going to base it on the individual. But I would say for a patient in this situation, once a day seems adequate. And you may say, well, what time of day should she check? And I would say I would rotate it. So we might ask her, well, for 1 week, check only in the morning or before meals, the target 80 to 130. And then for the next week, check 2 hours after dinner. So we get the pre-meal and the post-meal blood sugars. Her A1C is not dangerous. Her blood sugars aren't wildly high. They're just a little bit above, you know, target. So I could feel very comfortable saying, once a day for her, maybe twice a day if she is comforted by that. But again, I would look at what her insurance covers. But once a day could give us enough information. Let's just take a look at this same patient. And what if her A1C is 10.4? How often should she check? Once a day, twice a day, 2 to 3 times, as often as she agrees to. D. Now, let's just talk about medications for her. She's 10.4, so the American Diabetes Association algorithm says, well, she probably needs two medications at 10.4. Metformin, yes, but she might need to add a secondary medication, maybe some basal insulin. She's glucose toxic. Or she might need a GLP-1 agonist, like the Byetta, Bydureon, Victoza, those medications. So we know she's running, you know, above 200, 300s, and maybe we need to be more aggressive in our medications, in addition to, of course, lifestyle and seeing a dietitian. But how often should you check? I'm going to close. I didn't give you an answer, like how often. So this is kind of our personal beliefs and matching with the patient. So I'm going to go ahead and close this poll, and 17% of you said once a day. So I would have to say I'm more in the category in this situation, you know, A1C, pretty elevated, blood sugars around 300. I would say twice a day or 2 to 3 times a day, at least till we get her stabilized. And then I would also say as often as she agrees to. So B, C, and D are answers that I would choose. She may say, you know what, I'm just overwhelmed. You know, I'm taking care of my grandkids. I can't check my blood sugar twice a day. I would say, okay, what would you be able to do? I'll do once a day. I'll take it. or I may say, you know what, I'm really concerned. Your blood sugars are running 300. Let's work together to figure out how to get your blood sugars to target, and then we could back off a little bit. Would you be willing to check 2 times a day? And she might say, yeah, I could do that. I could do that for a month, and then let's just see how it goes. And so there is no one right answer for this. The best answer is D, as often as she agrees to. And with new diabetes and blood sugars running that high, I would want at least 2 times a day and maybe 3 times a day. And so, and if she doesn't want to do it, I'll negotiate 1 a day. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to share that poll. So here's your answers. I'll just show you briefly. And yeah, diabetes is really all about the individual. There's no one right answer for every situation. And so part of the goal of this program is to give you those critical thinking, you know, ideas. Like, what would you consider when suggesting how often to check the blood sugars? What would you factor in? And so that, I think, is a helpful conversation to have. Now, if you're running into roadblocks, if the patient's like, I really don't want to check my blood sugar, you know, or maybe they are checking their blood sugar and they're so discouraged, I love this, these ideas. This is Ann Peters. I was at a lecture at the ADA postgrad, and she goes, I hug all of my patients after their visit. And she goes, I actually give them a physical hug, but in addition, she helps with unconditional guidance and support. Diabetes is so hard. Diabetes is a daily, you know, a daily challenge. What am I going to eat? What are my blood sugars? All the medications they have to take. So we really want to come from a non-judgmental place and provide them with the support and guidance that they need based on their individual situation. Carl Rogers talks about unconditional positive regard. And it shows, you know, it's our ability to show support and acceptance no matter what a person says or does. So I hear patients tell me a lot of different things, and I just really understand it from a perspective of, oh, this is what they're struggling with. These are things that are stopping them from their diabetes. And how can we coach them and move them in a direction to better self-care if they can? No one is unmotivated to lead a long and healthy life. This is Bill Polansky, who does a lot of work in diabetes and the psychosocial aspects of care. There are usually 3 critical barriers. And so a lot of patients come to see me and they say, I'm not exercising. I go, tell me what's stopping you. I ask that question all the time. Tell me what's stopping you from exercising. Tell me what's stopping you from checking your blood sugars. It's very direct. It's non-judgmental. And I get a lot of good information with that question. And they'll say, well, it's not really worth it. Perceived worthlessness. Why should I do it? It's not helping my blood sugars. So if nobody has been helping them make adjustments to get their blood glucose to target, they may feel really discouraged. And maybe they say to me, there's just too many obstacles. I'm trying to work and get things done, and in the morning I got to, you know, make breakfast for my family, and I just don't have time. So those are legitimate obstacles. Absence of support and resources. I had one gal come in to see me the other day. She goes, my husband comes home with donuts and chips and all these different foods, and I'm trying to eat healthily. And so that is not receiving support for her decision to eat better. And so once we identify these barriers, which are legitimate, which are real, we can help patients work around them. They can go over them, under them, around them, and we're going to work with them to help them come up with solutions, right? Because if they come up with a solution, it's much more likely to succeed. So we want to help patients overcome barriers, and we want to confront the key misbelief. And here's a good question to ask patients. Does diabetes cause complications? And if I ask you all that, does diabetes cause complications? You know, you might say, yeah, but that's not actually true. Uncontrolled diabetes causes complications. So if you think if you have diabetes, you're going to get complications, why bother is what happens a lot. And so we want to let them know your decisions every day makes a difference. You can help prevent complications, and that is another empowerment tool. Offer evidence-based hope message. You starting today can help prevent or reduce your risk of complications. The more contact people get, the more likely they are to succeed. That's where support groups come in to really help people on an ongoing basis with their diabetes. Paired glucose testing is what I was talking about. Have some pizza. Check your blood sugar 2 hours later. Vacuum the house. What happens to your blood sugars? Go for a walk. You know, having them do that, they can see that their action directly affects their blood sugars. Ask the patient, tell me one thing that is driving you crazy about your diabetes. And by doing that, we'll find the biggest barrier and we can start addressing it with them. And then medication beliefs. I had a gal come in to see me. She was prescribed 3 different medications. She wasn't taking 2 of them because she said to me, well, I've heard metformin causes liver problems. And so we discussed that. I go, no, it actually doesn't cause liver problems. But if your liver isn't working right, it's probably not a good medication for you, but it's not going to harm your liver. And so we want to find out what medications they're on and how often they're taking them. And if they're not taking them, find out why. So important. What about alternate site testing? When can patients use their finger, the palm of their hand, the top of their leg to monitor their blood sugars? Well, if they have finger fatigue, their blood sugars are stable, they don't have a risk of hypoglycemia, but if their blood sugar is less than 90 and they're using alternate site testing, recheck on their finger. Who should not use alternate site testing? If you're pregnant, on intensive insulin therapy, if you're having low blood sugar and during illness. So it's not as accurate during glucose fluctuations, so you want to avoid using alternate site testing during that time. But if the patient's stable, they have A1C of 6.7, they're not on intensive insulin therapy, it's a fine alternative. Gives them a little break and helps reduce that finger fatigue. Here's some things we want to help to make sure as far as baseline learning and monitors, that they know how to care for their strips, where to dispose of lancets, what their blood glucose targets are. If you don't know your target, how can you achieve it? The importance of not only getting your blood glucose, but writing it down. So I work a lot with patients of keeping a log or downloading it on their computer. I don't care, but you just need to keep track of what your blood sugars are, because otherwise they don't help you that much. You have to see patterns. There's an 800 number on the back of every meter if they're having trouble. So let them know about that number and encourage them to call. The number one reason for inaccurate results is user error. So if they're having trouble, watch them check their blood sugar and you'll see right away what the situations are and what's kind of blocking them from success. The other thing is this thing called monitor talk, and I talked about this a little bit earlier, and even as a diabetes educator, when I look at their logbooks, I won't say to them, wow, these are great blood sugars, or these are not good at all. I won't use good and bad as my words. What I'll say is, oh, those blood sugars are above target, or oh, those blood sugars are below target. I use emotionally neutral language because I don't want them to be too hard on themselves. And when they bring in their logbook, you want to say stuff like, wow, I am really impressed you are checking your blood sugar once a day and writing it down. So we want to focus on the behavior, not the blood sugar. We want to reward the action that they're taking, and then help them use a blood sugar numbers to make some changes. I am curious to learn, what is helping you succeed with blood sugar testing? These are called curiosity questions. So a patient comes in and their blood sugars are at target 80% of the time. We want to find out why they're succeeding, because we want to help them carry on that behavior. Look at this. I am interested to see that you are skipping some days. Can you share more about that? Interesting. So maybe they're just kind of burned out on their diabetes. So by asking a question that's non-judgmental and non-confrontational, we get information that can be really helpful. Let's do one more here. A patient brings in his logbook, and you notice all of his blood glucose numbers end in zero, like 110, 120, 140. What do you think is happening here? Patient is writing in numbers to please a provider. Patient is non-compliant and cheating. Patient is covering up high blood sugars. Or patient's meter is broken. Which of the following do you think it is? All right. Thanks, everyone, for voting. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this. Thank you, everyone, for voting. I'm going to share this. I think this is a really important point. So when I see a patient come in with blood sugar numbers that are obviously created and not really a reflection of what's happening, I am seeing a patient that wants to please their provider, and that I'm also seeing a patient that's covering up high blood sugars. I don't see a patient who is non-compliant and cheating. I see a patient struggling with their diabetes and a patient that's afraid of being reprimanded. And so when I see something like that, I might say, you know what? I see here your numbers are all ending in zeros, 110, 120, 140, and I'm wondering if these numbers really reflect what your blood sugars are. And then I'll say something like, you know what? No matter what your blood sugars are, I really appreciate all the work you're doing, and I'm not going to judge your blood sugar numbers. I'm just here to support you in getting to the best place possible with your diabetes. So I give you total permission to be honest in documenting what your blood sugars really are. It's okay. And so I'll just try and open the door and let that be. And I'll say, you know what? Are you, and I want to also evaluate, are you struggling checking your blood sugars? Maybe we're asking them to check more frequently than they really can. So I might renegotiate that too and say, hey, would you be willing just to check once a day and give me the true number? Let's just start there. And so I don't really particularly believe in noncompliance. I believe that patients are embarrassed, struggling, they have shame, they want to please, and we need to give them total permission to be honest and truthful with us. Even if that means they're doing nothing, I just want to know, because if you're doing nothing, we need to figure out why, what's blocking you, and take it from there. Okay, let's take a look at Joe. Well, his name is actually JR. Of course, these are all just imaginary patients. Suddenly, his blood glucose levels are in the 200s. He is not hungry. He has nausea and diarrhea and some fever. He's on metformin. How often should he check his blood glucose, and when should he call his doctor, and should he keep taking his metformin? So you all know that when you get ill, your blood sugars, which have been previously well under control, can suddenly go up. And I always tell patients, your blood sugars are an indicator of how well your body is balanced. And so if you see your blood sugars going up out of the blue, see if you're sick. Do you have a flu, a tooth abscess, some other problem that's happening? And you need to, of course, check your blood sugar more frequently. So let's just take a look at sick days, and we'll come back to JR. So what they say for sick day management is take medications. Don't stop your diabetes medications, but you may need to adjust your dose down or up. But I put a little asterisk here. If at risk of dehydration, we want to hold metformin. So metformin is one of the medications that we might actually have the patient hold if they're at risk for becoming very dehydrated, especially if the patient already has a creatinine that's a little bit up or they're kind of a little more frail. Let's keep going. Test glucose at least every 4 hours, but if they're too sick to do it themselves, they're going to need to get some help. Drink a lot of fluid. When you're sick, drink, drink, drink. And if you're This is really an important point. If you can't eat food, I want you to drink fluid that has calories, like 7-Up, apple juice, clear liquids, Jell-O. I want you, if you can't eat regular food, this is the time that you're going to drink fluid that has calories in it. But if they can't eat food, drink water. Just keep drinking fluids. Rest. Contact physician. Plan ahead. And if your blood sugar is more than 240, and you want to check those urine ketones. Reasons to call the doctor: if you're vomiting more than once, diarrhea more than 5 times or 24 hours, you can't breathe, always a good reason to call your doctor. This is really an important one. If the blood sugar is more than 300 on 2 consecutive readings, of course, if you have patients who always run 300, that doesn't make sense. But this is for patients who normally have pretty decent control and they just can't get that blood sugar down. If their temperature is more than 101, it's usually for about a day, and they have ketones in their urine. So let's take a look at JR. So he is not hungry. He's not eating. Drink sugary fluids. He needs some calories. He has nausea and diarrhea and fever. On metformin, how often should he check his blood sugar? I have here 2 to 4 times a day. When should he call the doctor? If he's not better in 24 hours, or if his blood sugar's, 300 times 2 and he just can't keep anything down. Should he hold his metformin? Well, if he's at risk for dehydration, he should. But this guy looks pretty young. He might be able to, just take less metformin. But I'm kind of worried if he stops metformin altogether, his blood sugar might go very high. So this might be a time that he calls his doctor and is in contact and gets some direction. But certainly if they're older or their creatinine is elevated, hold a metformin during sick days. Let's just move to the hospital for a few seconds. I have a whole program on hospitalization and our level 2, but what about if a patient is sick and in the hospital, how do we manage their diabetes? We definitely know that hyperglycemia in the hospital setting is associated with increased mortality and morbidity, and it deserves our attention. So anyone in the hospital with elevated blood sugars should be treated and be given insulin to get blood sugars down, even if they don't have a diagnosis of diabetes. So here's pre-diabetes, and I see a lot of patients in the hospital with pre-diabetes, and we need to counsel those patients and let them know your blood sugars are higher than normal. When you leave this hospital, you need to contact your provider, and then I'll give them referral to our diabetes education program to get some information to help stop the diabetes from moving forward if possible. But if their fasting glucose, even in the hospital, is 126 or greater, or a random of 200 or greater, we need to treat that. And that is, we might have detected undiscovered diabetes. Any blood glucose above 140 requires treatment, and that's from Dr. Umpieres et al., and that's the AACE guideline. So we need to be on the lookout for that hyperglycemia. And in the hospital, here's our targets. We talked about this last time and the standards of care. Critically ill patients, anybody above 180, start insulin, but we want that blood glucose target 140 to 180. And non-critically ill, pre-meal less than 140, post-meal less than 180. Insulin, preferred treatment, and we want to have a hypoglycemia management protocol in our hospital settings to make sure we treat hypoglycemia effectively and quickly. Managing hyperglycemia in the hospital, usually we stop oral agents, metformin and sulfonylurea, on admission, and then we move to insulin therapy. Really, insulin sliding scale use is discouraged. We want to manage them on basal bolus, which would be a combination of long-acting and short-acting insulins, and on discharge, get them back on their oral medications. But let's take a look at PZ. He's going to have gallbladder surgery. He's on metformin 500 milligrams twice a day and 20 units of Lantus at bedtime. His A1C is 6.9% in one situation, and I gave him an A1C of 10.3% in another situation. He's going to be NPO after midnight for this gallbladder surgery. What adjustments should we make in insulin, and what adjustments should we make in metformin? So I'm going to just give you all a case study. A poll here. He's having gallbladder surgery, and in this situation, the first one, his A1C is 6.9. He's on 20 units of Lantus, usually at home, and metformin in the morning. What should we do? Should we give 50% of Lantus dose and hold AM metformin? Should we give 100% of the nighttime Lantus dose and give AM metformin? Should we give 100% of Lantus and hold the morning metformin, or should we just hold insulin altogether? What do you think we should do? His A1C is 6.9. So we know his average blood sugar is, around 140-ish. All right. I can see it's really great watching these polls because I can see you guys changing your answers. So you're like, it's hard. This is really challenging. How do you manage blood sugars pre-surgery? It's not easy. So I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share. And so there's no one rule on this that I could give you, but I would say A would be what I would choose. A patient who has really great blood sugar control and their blood sugars are running around 140s, the A1C is 6.9, I'm kind of nervous to give him 20 units of Lantus at bedtime because for type 2s, when they don't eat, their blood sugars can go really low. And so I would say I would give 10 units, cut the nighttime dose in half, and hold a morning metformin. So what if his A1C was 10.3? I'm going to hide this. What action would you take then? Would you give 50% of his Lantus dose and hold the morning metformin? Would you give 100% and his metformin? Or would you give 100% and hold AM metformin? Or would you hold insulin altogether? So if my A1C is 10.3, I'm more toward the 300s, right? I'm running 300 all the time. And so I know this patient runs chronically high. What does that tell me? He's always high. Would I feel okay giving him his full dose of insulin? Okay, well, most of you have voted. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to close this and share it with you. So I agree with C. Give 100% of Lantus and hold morning metformin. So the day of surgery, we always hold metformin. But generally speaking, as far as the Lantus the night before, we might give 100% or we might give less. And we really base how much Lantus we give the patient on where their blood sugar control usually is. So I would just say if the patient comes into the hospital, their blood sugars are really well controlled and they're supposed to get 20 of Lantus the night before and their A1C is 6.9, I would say cut that in half. If the A1C is 10.3 and their blood sugars are always running 300, I know that 20 units of Lantus is not going to make them crash in the morning, so I would feel more comfortable giving them the full dose. But having said that, I would ask the patient. I would say to the patient, hey, you know, what happens when you take 20 units of Lantus? And now if this 10.3 guy tells you, oh, and my morning blood sugar is always 200. See, I'm not worried at all. But what if he tells you, well, lately my blood sugar in the morning has been running 90s? You see, that's going to change my whole perspective. But just given this information, I would feel less comfortable giving the full dose to the guy with the A1C of 6.9. So let me just show you what the standards say. These are the standards. So I gave you first kind of how I would look at it, and I'll just show you what the standards say. For anybody with surgery, try to schedule surgery in the morning with diabetes and resume meds and insulin when eating and stable. Oral medications, hold morning dose. If on sulfonuria, may need to hold night before dose too. Basal insulin. For type 2s, give 50 to 100% of usual AM or PM basal dose. And so we have a range here. And this range is based on how they respond to insulin and what their blood sugars do. For type 1s, we give all of their basal insulin, and we individualize that too. Bolus insulin, you'll use mild insulin bolus coverage for type 1s and type 2s. So what's that saying? If they wake up and they're 300, we might have to give them, you know, some fast-acting insulin to get them closer to 200 before surgery. But if they wake up and they're 140, we're probably not going to give them any bolus coverage. Okay, I hope that was helpful. So here's kind of my answer. 6.9, only give 10 units of that Lantus. And if he's 10.3, full dose probably okay, but I would definitely check in with the patient too. I have a very detailed webcast on hospitalization, DKA, and HHS on our Level 2 online series. So in Level 2, I spend an hour going over this and 45 minutes on DKA and HHS. So you can check that out if you want some more information. So to wrap up, let's talk about lower extremities. And here's my motto, lift the sheets and look at the feet. So I worked in the hospital for many years of my life, and I always tease the providers because I'm like, okay, you did a head-to-ankle assessment. Let's look at the feet. And even now, a lot of my patients wear booties, and nobody's taking out the booties and looking at the feet. So we want to give the feet a good look. Maybe they look like this with some tattoos on there. What does that tell us about the patient? Well, maybe those are henna tattoos, or maybe they're a parent and their kid marked all over their foot. We don't really know. We're going to ask. So it just gives us permission to ask questions. Hey, how do you take care of your feet? What if the feet look like this? So now we know right away. What are you guys thinking? Heart failure, right? that they have a lot of pedal edema. And my first thought, to be honest with you, is how are they going to get a shoe to fit on that foot? So I know this patient's foot is at high risk for problems. There's a lot of fluid in there, and you can see she's elevating it to try and get that edema down. Or what if the feet look like this? I've seen these feet in the hospital where the toenails are grown so long they curve back into the skin, where there's bad calluses on the bottom of the feet. If you look at his legs, you can see they're very lean. He probably has some peripheral arterial disease. And when I look at this foot, I see a patient maybe who can't reach their foot, who maybe has poor vision, has a misshapen foot, who needs help. I see in this foot a patient who needs assistance of others to do better foot care. And so right away I'm thinking about resources for this patient and that it's urgent. We need to help him right away. So let's just take a look at some risk factors that increase or decrease the risk for lower extremity disease and vascular problems. We know that there's certain non-modifiable risk factors. The longer you have diabetes, the more your risk. The older we get, and different ethnicities and races have different risk, and of course our family history. But the thing I want to focus on are there are some risk factors that are modifiable. Like we can get blood pressure down, lipids, quit smoking, lose weight, exercise more, eat more healthfully. All of these things can help improve circulation. And so when I look at patients' legs, which I look at, you know, every patient that I meet for diabetes care, I look at their lower extremities. It's just part of what we do as diabetes educators. I can identify what kind of disease they have by looking at their legs, or maybe they have no disease. But this patient has venous disease, and that means the blood can get to her feet, no problem, but the blood is having a hard time getting back up to her heart, so the fluid pools in her lower extremities. This foot, if you touch it, is warm, it's mottled, it's reddish, it may be edematous, so the fluid is staying there and leaking out. They might have stasis ulcers on their legs, and you're trying to get the pulses, you can't feel them, there's too much fluid. What is treatment for this patient? Well, support hose, elevate the feet, avoid constriction, so none of those, you know, knee-high nylons, very dangerous for people in this situation. And make sure this woman has shoes to accommodate her feet. If she has neuropathy on top of this swollen foot, you can see she's at such high risk for foot problems. So you really want to get her the care that she needs. On the other end is peripheral arterial disease. It affects 30% of people with diabetes over the age of 50. So the blood cannot get down to the extremities. There's inadequate blood and oxygen. And this actually signifies increased risk of stroke, hypertension, and sudden death. So peripheral arterial disease is really serious. These patients will complain that when I walk, my calves hurt. It's called intermittent claudication. They might also complain of cramping in their calves, thighs, and buttocks. If they have peripheral arterial disease plus neuropathy, very high risk for amputation. So when we look at our patient's extremities, we're going to identify that they have lack of circulation because their skin is pale or blue or purple. When they hang their legs down, it gets red. When you lift your leg up, it gets totally pale. The other thing is it's cool to touch, and there's no hair on their feet. You know, I always tell my patients, grass don't grow where water don't flow. And that means if you don't have good circulation to your extremities, the hair doesn't grow. So hair on your toes is a good sign. The ladies don't like it, but it's a good sign. And then, of course, you don't feel pulses because the blood flow isn't getting down there. So what's the treatment? Protect the feet. Avoid constriction. Keep walking. Even if they complain of intermittent claudication when walking, the more they walk, the more collateral blood vessels they build up and the better their circulation. So get out there and walk. So important. And just every time that hurts, sit down, take a break. These patients actually might benefit from medications or surgery, and certainly getting them to see a vascular surgeon or a lower extremity specialist is really important. The American Diabetes Association just updated their foot care standards, and they say provide foot care education to all patients with diabetes. High-risk patients, we want to use interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary approach. Maybe we can involve, you know, of course, diabetes education, wound specialists, vascular specialists, podorthists, people who specialize in making shoes for people with diabetes. Refer to foot care specialists for lifelong surveillance. If they smoke, they don't have protective sensation, they have abnormalities in the shape of their feet, or they have a history of lower extremity complications. Once a person with diabetes gets an ulceration or has an amputation, they're much more likely to have a future complication. They're very high risk. And we want to screen for peripheral arterial disease, looking for intermittent claudication, look for pulses, and refer those patients for further vascular assessment and consider the different options. So here's a profile of a high-risk foot. So as educators, we're trying to identify who is high risk. And if they're high risk, let's get them the resources they need to prevent things from happening. And we've talked about a lot of these, but vision impairment. So if they have retinopathy, they're more likely to have neuropathy in their feet. And if they have visual impairment, they're less likely to identify problems happening with their extremities early on. So if they have neuropathy, especially if on dialysis, much higher risk for foot problems, blood sugars are high, and they smoke. All of these are independent risk factors that increase the risk for foot problems in the future. These patients need to be checked frequently, and they need a lot of education and support. So diabetes means you have an eightfold risk of getting an amputation. Highest rate in those over the age of 75. So we really want to assess our more senior patients' risk of foot problems. But look at this. Here's the good news. 50% of amputations can be avoided through self-care education and early intervention. So we can do a lot. If each one of us listening today, you know, just provided education to 10 patients, we would save a lot of extremities. The good news is the rate of amputations did decline 65% from 1996 to 2008. And I'm just going to give, you know, those of us in the education field the credit because we're teaching patients about the great foot care. Okay, so there's the rates. That's our stats from the CDC. So here's what a healthy foot looks like. Now, the foot to me, and I'm sure to many of you, is a work of art. We have the bone structure, very complex bone structure. We have an arch. It's flexible. It moves. It adjusts. It bends. It's just wonderful. And so that's what a healthy foot should look like. But a lot of our patients with diabetes, especially diabetes for a long period of time, get this thing called a claw foot, and it's a shortening of the tendons. And so the foot takes on this deformed shape, and you can see there's a lot more pressure on the top of the toes and on the pads of the feet. So this person here has callus buildup because they're putting a lot more pressure on places that the foot isn't used to because of the change of the shape of the foot. This is associated with neuropathy, actually. So neuropathy and vascular disease combined can cause this alteration in foot shape. And I know you have seen feet like this. And this patient certainly would benefit from supportive care and special shoes. Let's take a look at LR. LR has type 2 diabetes for 8 years. He's been on glyburide for 8 years. His A1C is 8.7. He doesn't know how to check his blood sugars. Nobody ever taught him. He smokes a pack per day, and he has calluses on his feet that he trims with a razor. So these calluses, see that? Trims them with a razor. So I want to ask you this question. Which of the following patient behaviors can save feet? A, inspect feet daily. B, trim calluses gently with a razor blade. C, soak feet daily in Epsom salt. Or D, cut nails short and close to the quick. Which of the following? There's only one right answer on this one. Oh, you guys are way too smart. I couldn't even tempt you with any of my other answers. Okay. Thank you for voting, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. Of these four things, the only right thing is inspect your feet every day. So let's just take a look at what happened to this gentleman. This is a true story. And I was working at Stanford Hospital at the time, and this patient came in, and this was his You know, what he shared with me, and he had never received any foot care education ever in his life. And we know that any disruption of the skin provides an opportunity for bacteria to get in. Whether it's a blister or a wound in the foot, what happens is that blister might pop, or there might be a callus, and underneath there's tissue being broken down from the callus, and that can lead to ulcerations, and so now the bacteria get in and it can cause osteomyelitis or a bone infection. And so we always want to help our patients to maintain the integrity of their skin and their feet. So important, because the skin is a protective barrier. And so this patient who I was talking about did have a callus on the bottom of his foot. He took a razor blade. He was, you know, scraping the bottom of his foot to get that callus off, and he had neuropathy. So he didn't feel that he was getting to the healthy tissue, but in fact he was. And so he cut off that callus, the healthy tissue was exposed, and the bacteria just went in, and he has this huge infection on his foot. If you could touch his foot, it is hot. It is on fire. He has cellulitis. And so he went to the operating room, and we were hoping we could save, you know, his foot. And he came back after surgery with a partial foot amputation. And to this day, I know that we could have saved this patient's foot if he would have got the one piece of education, and that is no bathroom surgery, no razor blades to calluses, don't cut your toenails using a wire cutter, don't use Dr. Scholl's corn removers to get rid of painful corns. That has salicylate, it has acid in it. It can burn through the corn and get to healthy tissue. So we really want to ask our patients, tell me how you take care of your feet. And number one thing, no bathroom surgery. That's just so important for patients to help prevent complications. And so we can make a difference. We want to ask our patients, how do you take care of your feet? And then we're going to look at their nail condition. How do they take care of their nails? Can they cut their nails? Really important. A lot of our patients can't reach their nails to cut them. And if they can't reach them, they can't cut them. They need help. And then we want to make sure they don't cut too close to the quick, because that can result in cutting your flesh and causing infection. Look in between toes. In between toes is a place where dead skin and bacteria can thrive. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure they can clean in between their toes. And I just have my washcloth ready, and I get rid of that dead skin, in between their toes to help prevent fissures and macerations. And then I ask, hey, who trims your nails? Are you having trouble? And have you ever cut yourself? And if they have, I really want to make sure to refer them to a podiatrist. Look at their shoes. When they take off their shoes, are there red marks? Do the shoes fit? What do their socks look like? Making sure there's no seams on their socks. And can they inspect their feet? Then I'm going to see if they have loss of protective sensation, which I'll show you in a minute. But as far as lower extremity care, the American Diabetes Association says for anybody at risk for foot problems who have loss of protective sensation, foot deformities, or a history of foot ulcers, every time they see their provider, take off your shoes and socks and show your feet. So this is another way to help patients keep their feet in good shape. So what we can do as diabetes educators is use a monofilament to assess loss of protective sensation. This simple 10-gauge nylon monofilament is designed to be able to test if the patient has nerve disease. If they can't feel the pressure from this monofilament, they have lost nerves. Their nerves have died. They have neuropathy. So what you want to do is press this monofilament against different places on the person's foot. You don't have to do all of these. I'll show you actually. These are the sites you want to test. And what you say to the patient is, tell me when you feel it. And you have to bend the monofilament in a C. That delivers 10 grams of pressure. And so you say, tell me when you feel it. And they close their eyes. And I rotate my sites. I don't do it standard. And if they can't feel it in one or more places, and I do every site twice, they have loss of protective sensation. This simple device can save feet. Because if I determine they have loss of protective sensation, I'm going to do a lot of teaching around looking at your feet every day. Before you put your shoes and socks on, You know, make sure there's nothing in your socks. There's nothing in your shoes. Make sure your shoes fit well. After you take off your shoes, is there any red marks? So we're going to do everything we can to protect their feet and certainly encouraging them never to go barefoot. I do want to say you can get 10 free monofilaments when you go to this website. It's a lower extremity amputation prevention program, LEAP. And they have not only free monofilaments, but lots of videos to help you to provide information on doing a foot assessment. They're just a tremendous resource. I would really encourage you to go there. So the three most important foot care tips: inspect and apply lotion to your feet every night before you go to bed. Lotion is important. It prevents the feet from getting too dry and cracked and letting bacteria in. Don't go barefoot, even in your house. Always wear shoes. And every time you see your doctor, take off your shoes and show your feet. Report any problems right away. So those are just some information to share with our patients, and to know that Medicare pays for therapeutic shoes, that if you have loss of protective sensation, Medicare will cover for one custom pair of shoes a year and two inserts. And so this is a wonderful resource for our patients to have access to. I do have a complete and detailed course in Level 2 on lower extremity assessment. I'm just kind of giving the basics to get us started, but if you want more information on this topic, we do have a more detailed webcast that you can take a look at. Finally, I just like to wrap up with spiritual care. When we meet our patients with diabetes, many times they're really struggling with their diabetes and they feel discouraged and hopeless. And so the thing I think about a lot is kindness. Here this says, the highest form of wisdom is kindness. And how many times has a patient arrived in our office disheartened and beating themselves up because their blood sugars are too high, their weight's too high, they're not eating right? And we want to remind them that having diabetes is not their fault and no one can do it perfectly. By modeling kindness and understanding, we can encourage them to be a kinder self-coach. So the way they talk to themselves is really important too. So by showing them kindness, we encourage them and give them permission to be kind to themselves. I love this quote by Rumi: out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. And this just comes to say that people with diabetes often feel judged by others, including providers, family, friends, and even sometimes by diabetes educators. When we can provide a gift of non-judgment, we can help open unexpected doors of insight and understanding. Meeting them in a field of understanding and compassion can provide them with the courage and belief that they can start to rewrite their journey. You know, diabetes is a self-managed condition, and no one can manage diabetes but the person living with it. And so what we want to do is, you know, we can't motivate people to take care of themselves. They have to find the motivation within themselves. So we want to ask people, what is your motivating spark? What would drive you to make healthier life choices? And our job is to help discover the spark that moves people toward healthy behavior. Once a spark is discovered, only one person can ignite it, but we stand close by holding the match. We're there to support, coach, and encourage, but ultimately, it's a person living with diabetes every day that has to do the work. This is a quote I love: getting diabetes saved my life. If you know Sherry Shepherd, she got diabetes and was just like, wow, really shocked by getting it. But she didn't let it faze her. She said, you know what? I'm going to take charge of this. And she decided to embrace diabetes and use it as a motivator to improve her health. So like many people I work with, having diabetes for them is often the turning point where they start saying, you know what? I think it's time to take care of myself. It's time to eat right, to exercise, to really make some changes in my life. And it can be a turning point for many people. So sometimes I try and help them reframe the diabetes in this way, and I talk about Sherry Shepherd, and it's really inspiring for them. Diabetes vacations. The greatest glory in living lies not in never falling, but in rising every time we fall. Nelson Mandela. You know, a lot of my patients go on what I call diabetes vacations, where they stop taking their, checking their blood sugars, or, you know, they take their insulin. They're supposed to be on it four times a day. Maybe they're taking it twice a day. And maybe they just gave up on eating, and they're just, you know, not really following any type of meal plan. But they call us. They reach up and they call us, or maybe they come to our support group, and they're ready to get back on track. They're ready for help. And so they're trusting that we're going to help them back up with a kind and gentle hand. And then we want to embark on a process of discovery. We want to look for those barriers to self-care. We want to give permission for those emotions swirling around their diabetes to be expressed, because there's a lot of, many times, anger around diabetes. And by letting them express it and acknowledge how hard diabetes is, many times they can start working toward accepting it. Then we want to make one small goal with them, work together to determine a goal that can signify their commitment and try to get back on track. And this goal has to be absolutely achievable so that they can succeed. I just was working with a patient, and we just decided on the other day, we made a very small goal that 3 days a week she would get up for 10 minutes and do something, walk around, housework, something very simple that she felt she could 100% achieve. So when we make our goals, we want to make sure they're realistic for that patient. For one patient, all we worked on is she was eating a bag of chips every day at 2 p.m. And we said, you know, she said, I want to stop eating that bag of chips. And we made that goal, and she was very successful at it. So we want to work with our patients to figure out what is a realistic goal and remind them that they don't have to be perfect. And this is a picture of me and my mom. And my mom was recently diagnosed with diabetes, and she's on insulin. And, you know, we talk a lot, and I'm encouraging her with her diabetes. And she kind of was feeling like she had to do it perfect. And I said, Mom, you don't have to be perfect. It's not reasonable or expected. It's not what we're looking for. And so I talk a lot about the 80-20 rule, that 80% of the time you want to get to target, and 20% you just can't reach it because it's too hard to do it perfect all the time. And so I think that's a really good place for our patients to start, to realize that the goal is not perfection. The goal is just to get it right most of the time. I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fun to have you as part of this Diabetes Fundamentals series. And just because we're done with the fundamentals doesn't mean our relationship is over. You can sign up for the Level 2 series bundle. And also, we'll be having a diabetes educator course in Carmel in April in San Diego. In September, we'd love for you to come join us on either. And I really want to thank you for all the work you're doing, reaching out to people living with diabetes every day. And as usual, I'm going to end the recording aspect of this, but I will stay for any questions that you might have. Thanks again for joining us. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.